The other day, an undergraduate cornered me in Harvard Yard and asked what all this was leading up to, all these musico-linguistical meditations of the last two lectures. What am I getting at, she asked. Do I really believe in the analogies I suggest between transformational grammar and musical transformations? And I was very brave and stoutly responded, yes, I deeply believe in the analogies. And I found that this linguistic approach to poetry illuminates musical analysis and vice versa. And in fact, so have some linguists I've heard from, much to my pleasure. And as far as what I'm getting at is concerned, it's a broad, dispassionate look at the musical crisis of our own century, as dramatized by Charles Ives' Unanswered Question, and analogously, how poetry shares in that crisis. But my bright new friend was only warming up her inquisition. I follow your linguistics, she said, but you begin to lose me when you start crossing Chomsky with aesthetics. How does transformational grammar lead to the beauty of ambiguity, as you put it? She's being a little bitchy. And to increased aesthetic response. Aren't you being a bit ambiguous yourself? I was suddenly not so facile in my response and found myself defensively trying to recall my original enthusiasms and impulses when I first conceived these lectures. I reminisced phonology, syntax, semantics, meaning. Meaning. Okay, I began, to her distress, by spewing out, as well as I could remember it, an analysis of a classical Chomsky-type ambiguous sentence. The whole town was populated by old men and women. We're now dealing with a third kind of ambiguity, I told her, neither phonological nor syntactic, but both. A new semantic ambiguity. I gave her a hasty rundown on why that sentence is ambiguous, without diagrams, of course. And unfortunately, because this is where Chomsky's tree diagrams are really valuable, the whole town was populated by old men and women is an ambiguous sentence because it has two different deep structures. The first would show us one meaning, that the town was populated by old men and old women, possibly because all the young people had gone off to the big city, leaving only the old folks behind. But there's a second meaning arising from the other deep structure and based on the idea, possibly, that all the young men had gone off to war, leaving behind old men and women of all ages. You see the difference. It's a whole other situation. Now, through our well-known processes of transformation, mainly deletions, those two deep structures have been combined and condensed into the one ambiguous phrase, old men and women. And that's a famous example, as you must know, of the figure of speech known as zeugma, meaning two nouns yoked to one adjective, as the nouns men and women are both yoked to the single adjective old. There's a fascinating and very helpful musical analogy to be made here, which I naturally couldn't demonstrate to my charming young inquisitor in Harvard Yard, stuck as we were in the middle of Harvard Yard. But I can demonstrate it for you. Think of this famous passage in Stravinsky's Petrushka. You all know that. Now, recalling our last lecture, just think of all that melodic material on top as a series of nouns. That's one. Here's another. Here's another. Another noun. So on. Now think of the harmonic support underneath as a verbal adjective. You remember those correlations we made? Never changing. And what have we got? A zeugma with the same unchanging adjective, modifying all those different nouns. So on. But back in Harvard Yard, my blonde inquisitor was getting impatient. Zugma schmugma, she said. Get to the point. What has all this got to do with poetry? Patience, I said. I'm just coming to the point. The big leap. By reapplying the transformational rule of deletion to that sentence, or prose surface structure, as it's called, the whole town was populated by old men and women, we can turn an already ambiguous sentence into an even more ambiguous one, a super surface structure. The whole town was old men and women. The whole town was old men and women. And that, for better or worse, is a line of poetry. The whole town was old men and women. A poetic statement. In fact, old men and women is all by itself a poetic phrase, resulting from the previous deletion of one old from the prosy phrase old men and old women. And now we've also deleted populated by, making it even more poetic because more ambiguous. It's now supercharged with meanings and therefore poetry. Maybe, said my pretty inquisitor, maybe it's poetry, but can you prove it? No, I can't. I can't prove anything. I could possibly explain it, again, by borrowing methodology from linguistics. A linguist would say, look, when you're confronted by a sentence like that one, the whole town was old men and women, which is syntactically correct, but semantically incorrect, since a town is a place and men and women are people and a place can't be people. So where does the is come in? When you're confronted by a sentence like that, your mind automatically goes through a series of decision-making steps. First, it seeks some grammatical justification of that semantic conflict, and finding none can then decide one of two things, to reject it as illogical, impermissible speech, or to find another level on which it may be acceptable, a poetic level. In other words, something in the mind intuits a metaphorical meaning and then can accept the semantic ambiguity on that level. Now, did that word metaphorical register with you? I hope so, because metaphor is our key to understanding. In fact, I just used a metaphor. I said metaphor is a key. In other words, I've made an equation between a figurative way of speaking called a metaphor and a small metal object called a key. I have said, in effect, this equals that, where this and that belong to two completely different and incompatible orders, exactly like the town and its inhabitants of old men and women. In other words, I've broken a semantic rule. But it's precisely this linguistic misdemeanor, breaking the rules, by which metaphor is achieved. Juliet is the sun, a famous classic example of this is that, equating two incompatible orders, one human and the other sidereal. Juliet is a human organism. The sun is a star. How do they get to be equal? How indeed, said my pretty new friend. Well, I replied, Chomsky would say that there are certain syntactic rules associated with lexical meanings. That is, we all possess a learned lexicon that has its own rules and classifications. Our mental dictionary in English, for instance, permits us to say such things as Trilling lectured on sincerity, which he did in the last Norton lecture, but forbids us to say sincerity lectured on Trilling. There are certain things we know about the lexical items sincerity and lecture on that prevent our saying that sincerity lectures on anything or anyone. Now, of course, Chomsky is not interested in, he may be interested, but he's not concerned with poetry. His inquiry is into normal human speech. And Juliet is the sun is abnormal human speech. It is, so to speak, illogical. But we can find the logic in it, the poetic logic, by using, ironically enough, Chomsky's own transformational principles. What if we were to construct a logical progression that would normalize Shakespeare's metaphor? We could say, there is a human being called Juliet. There is a star called the sun. The human being called Juliet is radiant. A star called the sun is radiant. Hence, the human being called Juliet is like a star called the sun in respect to radiance. Perfectly logical. Now come the transformations, which are all deletions, as you can imagine, That is, we delete all those logical but unnecessary steps that are built into the deep structure of any comparison and wind up with our conclusive simile, Juliet is like the sun, which is true in one respect, that they are both radiant. We then make the final supreme deletion of the word like, and behold, our simile is transformed into a metaphor. Juliet is the sun. This is that. Now, of course, that last metaphorical leap makes it false logic, as in that invalid syllogism they always throw at you in elementary logic courses. My dog is brown, your dog is brown, hence my dog is your dog. Wrong. My dog is like your dog in terms of brownness and only of brownness. Right, but it's not poetry. It's not a metaphor. It's only a simile belonging to the realm of literal discourse, whereas the false logical version, my dog is your dog, has its own inner metaphorical logic. Are you beginning to see what I mean? And there, in a nutshell, is the difference between art and what we loosely call reality, or real life. What must be clear by now is that a metaphor, or any comparative statement, even a simile, must function in terms of the two compared items being related to a third item, which is common to both. That is, we are comparing A and B, whether they are my dog and your dog, or Juliet and the sun, A and B, both of which must relate to a third factor, X, which is abstractable from both. If A is Juliet and B is the sun, then X is radiance, or any number of other things, but let's say radiance. And A is like X, and B is like X, therefore A is like B. Juliet is like the sun. We then delete the like, the supreme deletion, and now Juliet is the sun. And what a deletion is there. Of such transformations are metaphors made, and of such metaphors is beauty born. Terrific, said my blonde inquisitor. I think I understand you. What I don't understand is how you relate all this stuff to music. You will, I said, come to the next lecture. Well, this is it, and I hope she's here, because we've just reached the crucial point. You remember I spoke of the mind having to go through a series of decision-making steps when confronted by a semantic incongruity. First seeking justification, and then either rejecting it or accepting it on a poetic level. Well, add to that a whole other series of steps. These very ones we've been describing, namely the finding of an X factor to which A and B can both relate. My dog is your dog because they're both brown. But that can't be, says the mind. Oh, I see, it can be, in a poetic sense. That's the process. Now, all of that complex mental process takes place in a millisecond, a flash of time. Such is the wonder of our cerebral computer. But the moment we come to deal with musical metaphor, even that millisecond is eliminated, because we don't have to deal with the problems of A and B being incompatible. And why not? Because the A's and B's of music are not burdened by literal semantic weights like my dog or your dog or Juliet. If this is A, and this is B, we instantly perceive the musical transformation with no time or effort needed to explain that relationship in terms of semantic meaning. The only time required is the time it takes to play it. In fact, when you think of the number of transformations taking place in the short space of those few bars of bronze, it becomes almost incredible that it can all be instantaneously perceived. What we've called A in itself involves a transformation. The descending major third transformed to its exact inversion, an ascending minor sixth. So A already contains a metaphor, and so does B. You see? But in addition to that, B is a metaphor of A through the comparative transformation of A, which is transformed by lowering it one degree of the scale. And add to that the harmonic metaphor accompanying the melodic one. The A progression is tonic subdominant. And the B progression is dominant tonic. A beautiful parallelism and a shining case of this is that. So in music as well as in poetry, the A and B of a metaphor must also both relate to some X factor, not radiance or brownness, but a common factor such as the rhythm, di-rom, do-rim, or those harmonic progressions, 1-4-5-1. You see, there is still that triangular formation of A, B, and X to be reckoned with. And yet, with all this to be perceived, all these metaphors within metaphors, we still don't require even that 1 millisecond before perceiving it. There's no need to go through that can't be, oh, I see it can be in a poetic sense, because the music already exists in a poetic sense. It's all art from the first note. And there, Blondie, you have your introduction to musical semantics. But what is musical semantics as related to, but opposed to, verbal semantics? All right, first let's look briefly at the verbal side. I think most linguists will agree that semantics, which is the study of pure meaning, has always been the weakest of the three linguistic departments because it's the least studied. And that's because it's the hardest to render in truly scientific fashion. As a result, linguists have usually left semantic considerations to other disciplines like philology, etymology, lexicography, aesthetics, or literary criticism. And this fact has spawned some of the sharpest criticisms of Chomsky, mostly by his own disciples, the Young Turks, and many of whom are now busily engaged in an effort to evolve a theory of semantic structures which can be as scientifically sound as the syntactic one. In fact, Chomsky himself is said to be working in this area, trying to head off the Young Turks at the pass. But it's not easy, especially for us old Turks. You recall our experiment in monogenesis from the first lecture? How we prolonged the ictus of the proto-syllable ma and heightened it into a musical tone? Ma. Well, that was a fairly pure scientific attempt, but not so pure that we could for 1 second ignore the semantic resonance of motherhood in that one syllable, ma. Nor could we avoid amorous inferences in the syntactic entanglements of Jack and Jill during our last lecture, no more than Chomsky himself can avoid them when he speaks of Harry and John and golf and persuasion. It's a semantic trap that no linguist can totally avoid. And in the same way, as we've been discussing the musical equivalents of these linguistic areas, we too have been semantically entrapped. Willy-nilly, we've been dealing with semantics all along. In the first lecture on phonology, we dealt with the ordering of phonemic elements out of the harmonic series so as to produce meaningful tonal relationships. Meaningful. And in the second lecture on syntax, we were dealing with the ordering of those tonal relationships so as to produce meaningful structures. So that now when we come to consider musical semantics in general, what meanings are there left to deal with? Well, obviously, the musical meanings that result from the combination of both, of what we might call phonosemantics plus morphosemantics, meanings derived by the various transformational procedures with which we've been playing. Playing, that's the word that leapt out, and precisely the word I want to use. It sounds frivolous, I know, but it is, on the contrary, essentially related to our semantic thinking. Play is the very stuff and activity of music. We play music on our instruments just as the composer plays with notes in the act of inventing it. He juggles sound formations. He toys with dynamics. He glides and skips and somersaults through rhythms and colors. In short, he indulges in what Stravinsky called le jeu de notes, the game of notes, a striking concept of what music is. And why not? All music, even the most serious, thrives on its puns and anagrams. Where would Richard Strauss be without his musical puns? Or Bach and Beethoven without their musical anagrams? One can almost think of a whole given piece of music as a continuing game of anagrams in which there are, as it were, 12 letters, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, which can be juggled and rejuggled. And the constant rearrangement and transformation of these letters is made particularly rich by the combined possibilities of horizontal and vertical structures, melodic, harmonic, and contrapuntal anagrams, which, of course, language cannot do, even with its 26 letters. And music is further enriched by the extension of these possibilities to near infinity through the extraordinary variety of high and low registers and durations, dynamics, meters, rhythms, tempi, colorations. It's as if all music were one super game of sonic anagrams. But does this Stravinskian game concept of music really cover the subject? A game may serve a number of purposes: to release energy, to exercise the mind or body, to while away the time. A game may also have more affective functions: to compete, to show off, or to establish a shared intimacy with the opponent. Now, all these may well be functions of music too, and frequently are. But nobody's going to assert that music stops there. There's got to be more to it than those merely pleasurable functions, even if they do go so far as to constitute a refreshment of the spirit. Music does more than that, says more. Means, there's the problem. Means what? Sad, glad, moonlight sonata, revolutionary etude, bi-units of information, significational sensory effects, cybernetic feedback. What do you mean? Well, the very first young people's program I ever gave on television about 15 years ago was entitled, What Does Music Mean? And here I am still asking that question, and my answers haven't changed very much, but I think I can now present a more mature formulation of them, particularly since I have a more mature audience to tell it to. As concisely as possible, this is it. Music has intrinsic meanings of its own, which are not to be confused with specific feelings or moods, and certainly not with pictorial impressions or stories. These intrinsic meanings are generated by a constant stream of metaphors, which are all forms of poetic transformations. And this is our thesis. I believe that this thesis can be demonstrated, and in fact has already been partly demonstrated, even if not scientifically proved. And the reason for that is probably the very unscientific word metaphor, which I've already been using in a most metaphorical way, and will no doubt continue so to do. But I should clarify this broad use of the term, at least to the extent that we can distinguish one use from another. There are three specific ways in which I want to use the term metaphor. First, those intrinsic musical metaphors I've already mentioned, metaphors of a purely musical order, operating rather like those puns and anagram games we were speaking of. All these metaphors derive from transformations of musical material, those very Chomskyan transformations we investigated last week. By transforming any musical material from one state to another, as I showed earlier with the Brahms, we automatically arrive at the test equation of any metaphor, namely, this is that. Juliet is the sun. Secondly, we must define extrinsic metaphors by which musical meanings are related to non-musical meanings. In other words, certain semantic meanings belonging to the so-called real world, the world out there, the non-musical world, are assigned to musical art in terms of literal semantic values, namely extra-musical ones. This form of this equals that is typified in Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, which we'll be hearing after the pause after the break, intermission, in which certain notes are meant to be associated in the listener's mind, meant, mind you, to be associated in the listener's mind with certain images like merry peasants, brooks, and birds. In other words, these notes equal those birds. Again, this equals that in another form. And finally, we must think of metaphor in an analogical way as we compare those intrinsic musical metaphors, those pure ones, with their counterparts in speech, strictly verbal ones. And this comparison is in itself a metaphorical operation. It says this musical transformation is like that verbal one. This is like that. Delete like, and you've got the metaphor. Now, having defined my usages of metaphor, I suppose I am now committed to plunging into that eternal aesthetic debate. And it's a debate I don't particularly wish to prolong. So many excellent and sensitive minds have wrestled with this problem of the meaning of music, to say nothing of the meaning of meaning. Santayana and Croce, Prahl and Pratt, I.A. Richards and Bergson, Beardsley, Birkhoff, Babbitt, Susan Langer, and Stravinsky himself. And one thing they have always agreed on, in one way or another, is that musical meaning does exist, whether rational or affective or both. As hard as they've all tried to be logical, to avoid romantic generalizing or philosophical maundering, they have all had to bow eventually to some nagging truth which insists that those innocent F sharps and B flats, however sportively juggled or played with, do emerge from a composer's mind meaning something, nay, expressing something, and expressing what may otherwise be inexpressible. But wait a minute, isn't there a difference between meaning and expressing? There is, if we're to be at all accurate. When a piece of music means something to me, it's a meaning conveyed by the sounding notes themselves, what Hans Lick called sonorous forms in motion. A wonderful phrase. And I can report those feelings of mine back to you precisely in terms of those forms. But when music expresses something to me, it is something I am feeling. And the same is true of you and of every listener. We feel passion. We feel glory. We feel mystery. We feel something. And here we're in trouble because we cannot report our precise feelings in scientific terms. We can report them only subjectively. For me, the end of Sibelius' Second Symphony may be orange colors. For you, it may be a sunrise. For you, it may be a glorious sunset. For somebody else, it may be a triumphant battle. It's endless, subjectively. If we could collect sample feelings from a concert audience, lay them slide by slide on a lab table, compare them and find them consistent, then we'd know something. Then science would smile on our endeavors. But alas, feelings, whatever they are, slither past the scientific laboratory, and we are left asking such pseudo-scientific questions as, where does affect come into all this? Is it those intrinsic musical meanings that move us so deeply? Or is there a transference of affect via the notes from the composer to the performer to the listener? Are we feeling what Beethoven supposedly felt when he wrote these notes? Now, I know what I'm feeling. I'm feeling, please, please, I implore you, I'll do anything if... And comes the reply, yes, but only on certain conditions. Please, listen, pretty please. If you don't... On the other hand, if you do... Same answer comes again. And so on, through new methods of pleading. Coy. And wheedling. and so on, all through the movement. I could go through the whole thing with tears and passion and temper and bribery, and I could make up a whole drama of pleading and refusal, nothing specific, you understand, but a drama nonetheless, ending up with a firm agreement with the conditions accepted and everything settled. But did Beethoven feel all that? Or even anything like it? Did I just make up those feelings out of the blue? Or are they in some way, to some degree, related to Beethoven's feelings, which have been transferred to me through his notes? Of course, we'll never know. We can't call him up. But the probability is that both are true. And if so, we have just revealed a major ambiguity, a beautiful new semantic ambiguity to add to our fast-growing list. But whichever is true, the basic point remains. Music does possess the power of expressivity. And the human being does innately possess the capacity to respond to it. Everyone agrees on that, in one way or another. Even William James, who regarded our reaction to music as nothing but a nervous tick, where they disagree is in making the distinction between what music expresses and how it expresses it. The what is very hard to pin down, as we've seen, but the how we do know about, and that's metaphor. In any sense in which music can be considered a language, and there are some senses in which it cannot be considered a language, but in the sense in which it can be, it is a totally metaphorical language. Consider the etymology of the word metaphor: meta, beyond, and feren, to carry. Carrying meaning beyond the literal, the tangible, beyond the grossly semantic, to the self-contained Ding an sich of musical meaning. Metaphor is the generator, the power plant of music, just as it is of poetry. Aristotle puts metaphor midway between the unintelligible and the commonplace. It's a marvelous remark. It is metaphor, he says, which most produces knowledge. The artist cannot help but agree, nor can the lover of art. And Quintilian says it even more strikingly. He says that metaphor accomplishes the supremely difficult task of providing a name for everything. And by everything, he obviously meant our interior lives, the things that can't be named otherwise, our psychic landscapes and actions. And it is thus that poetry and music, but especially music, through its specific and far-reaching metaphorical powers, can and does name the unnameable and communicate the unknowable. Now, if we accept this general idea of music as a meta-language, and I can see no reason why we shouldn't, and if we relate it back to our investigation of transformational linguistics, then a remarkable and exciting hypothesis suddenly presents itself. Is it not conceivable that there exists an innate universal grammar of musical metaphor? Think of it. Just let your minds reprise what has led up to this point. The original idea of universality, that all grammars evolve from basically similar principles, that out of these formal universals arise cognate deep structures within the various particular languages, that via transformational paths, these deep structures then rise to the surface as normal speech in various languages, and that via a further transformational leap, those surface structures in turn re-evolve into what we call poetry. Now, given this chain of ideas, hasn't everything we've been saying for 3 weeks led us inexorably to the hypothesis that all transformational processes ultimately yield metaphoric results? That is, if you recall our parallel ladder chart from the syntax lecture, these processes can produce such results in language, but must produce them in music. In other words, don't all metaphors, verbal or musical, derive from transformational processes? I suggest that the answer is an overwhelming yes. In our last lecture, We saw how some of these transformational processes might operate analogously in Shakespeare and Mozart. Remember? It was a sort of game. That's really what we musicians do best, play games. And I now propose to continue playing that game in a more detailed way, to find musical equivalents for smaller, more specific metaphorical operations in language, namely simple figures of speech, such as antithesis, alliteration, and so on. And here my pretty young inquisitor might well interrupt again and say, how can you include simple figures of speech in the category of metaphor? Aren't they simply rhetorical devices, stylistic embellishments of language? Well, yes, they are. But they are also metaphors in miniature, to the extent that in every case they present A's and B's, which are equated with each other through a common relationship with a third factor, X. Only the X factor, in the case of figures of speech, is non-semantic. It's not radiance or brownness, but rather an abstract principle of design. And therefore, it's a true X factor, a symbol in the algebraic sense of X. For example, what is the X factor in the case of antithesis? Like this one from the Mikado. See how the fates their gifts allot. You know that one? A is happy, B is not. A opposed to B. Now, what is the X factor? The principle of contrast, the design of oppositions. Here's A, here's B, here's the principle of the design. There's the triangle. Now, we all recognize antithesis when we read a biblical psalm. For instance, the dead praise not the Lord, neither any that go down into silence, but we will bless the Lord from this time forth and forever. Antithesis, A versus B, they versus we. But in these lines, we recognize much more than a figure of speech, because through that figure of speech, we perceive a whole poetic meaning. Why set up the dead at all in opposition to us, the living? Isn't it enough to say we will bless the Lord? It's a perfectly good psalm idea. No, it's not enough, not for making this particular poetic statement. These verses are a microcosm, a poetic essence of the entire psalm, which is all established on antithesis, beginning, not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but to thy name give glory. And continuing that antithetical design by setting up the polar extremes of idols, which are of silver and gold, eyes have they, but they see not, and so on. And on the other hand, but our God is in the heavens, which in turn leads to further antitheses until we are finally ready to understand those last lines, distinguishing between the dead who praise not and us who do. We now perceive, through that continuing antithesis, that by the dead, the psalmist is speaking metaphorically of the idolatrous nations who worship the work of their own hands. Now, that's an example of how a simple figure of speech can be extended to permeate and qualify a whole poetic structure. Now, can this happen also in music? It can, and it does. There are millions of examples. I'll pounce on one at random. Mozart's great C minor piano sonata, which presents itself at the very outset in a striking antithesis. Now, I take it the antithesis is perfectly clear to you. There's A, which is countered by B. But you may argue, yes, maybe, but is it really the equivalent of verbal antithesis, of a heavenly God versus a man-made idol, a clear, tangible opposition? Isn't the Mozart rather an example of contrast than of antithesis? Yes, it does involve contrast. Loud versus soft, rising intervals versus falling ones, rough hammer blows versus tender entreaty, and so on. It is not a literary figure of speech, as in the psalm, but it is a figure of musical speech, and because of the abstract nature of music, the pure non-representational nature of music, such a figure can affect us with even greater directness and force than a verbal one. And again, as in the psalm, but even more than in the psalm, this figure of Mozart's musical speech is then extended to condition and characterize the whole poetic structure. Look at this marvel. That opening statement in itself, so abundant in its antithetical meanings. Is immediately answered by a counter statement. Now, this is not only a thematic answer to the first statement, but a harmonic opposition to it, since the first one proceeded from the tonic to the dominant. Was the tonic and proceeded to the dominant, right? While the counter statement does the opposite, starting with the dominant. Ending up with the tonic. And so we now have not one, but two antitheses, two of equal length conjoined to form yet a third, twice the length of either. And we could go on through the whole movement finding constant new sets of antitheses, but enough. I've taken more time than I meant to with this one figure of speech, antithesis, but it's awfully easy to be seduced by Mozart's music, and I did want you to understand what I meant by such a figurative device as antithesis becoming a basic structural principle, the metaphoric fountainhead, so to speak, of this whole Mozart sonata. But antithesis itself is founded on an even more basic structural principle, that of repetition. Where would those biblical or Mozartian antitheses be without the previous assumption of repetition, which can then be varied by applying to it the principle of opposition? Indeed, all figures of speech and all metaphors in speech and music alike depend ultimately on repetition, which is then subjected to variation or, as the linguists say, transformation. I can't stress this point strongly enough. In fact, it has been authoritatively suggested that the main reason a serious theory of musical syntax has been so slow to develop is the refusal of musical theorists to recognize repetition as the key factor. I think it was Nicolas Rivet, who was a great musicologist as well as a linguist, who proposed this argument. And his argument grows out of a proposition by Roman Jakobson, a great linguistic thinker and one of Chomsky's most influential teachers. And Jakobson, speaking of poetry, said, and I've reduced this quote, Jakobson said, "It is only by the regular reiteration of equivalent units that poetry provides an experience of time comparable to that of musical time." Unquote. Now, that would seem a gross oversimplification, especially if he is referring to the regular reiteration of metrical units. Da-da, 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 da-da hardly produces poetry. That's more like doggerel. But the moment we apply to that mechanical regularity the processes of transformation and variation, then we immediately see what he's getting at, and we can extend Jakobson's reiterative principle to include all facets of poetic diction, not only meter. For example, the repetition of elementary sounds, vowels, consonants, phonemes, which gives us the whole range of poetic assonance, from the simple alliteration of Shakespeare's Full Fathom Five to the complex and mysterious resonances of Milton in Paradise Lost, "Fragrant the fertile earth after soft showers," or of Gerard Manley Hopkins' sonorous hymn of praise for dappled things, "For skies of couple color as a brinded cow," to say nothing of the fascinating auditory correlatives that resonate in the poetry of Dylan Thomas, "And green and golden I was huntsman and herdsman," or the so-called prose of James Joyce, which is really poetry, "beside the rivering waters of the hither and thithering waters of night." And even more, we can see poetry born of the repetition of actual words, not just sounds, but whole words. Only think of the five consecutive nevers uttered by King Lear in his death scene. Never, 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 ever. We can expand the idea further to include the repetition of whole images, as in T.S. Eliot's quartets, or even the repetition of whole lines, a device so commonly found in the Bible or in poetic drama. Brutus is an honorable man, over and over again. Not to mention Gertrude Stein, who made a whole career out of repetition. But the point must be clear by now that it is repetition, modified in one way or another, that gives poetry its musical qualities, because repetition is so essential to music itself. And that's true of all metaphorical phenomena down to the last little figure of speech. Take alliteration, perhaps the simplest of all. Shelley writes, "Wild west wind." All right, back to our game. Where is such alliteration to be found in music? What is the equivalent of wild west wind? We find it everywhere in Beethoven's Eighth. In Schubert's Rosamunda. All alliteration. The Shostakovich Fifth Symphony. In the César Franck Symphony. And even in William Tell. That's all too easy. The game becomes really pro when we move from identical initial notes to identical initial groups of notes. And here the term alliteration is not enough. It becomes the far grander term anaphora, which in rhetorical circles names the device of beginning lines or stanzas with identical words or phrases, such as Tennyson's famous sequence, "Ring out wild bells to the wild sky, ring out the old, ring in the new, or ring out the grief that saps the mind," so on. Or one can find anaphora in almost any religious litany, such as the Beatitudes, as well as almost anywhere in Isaiah, "Woe unto them that draw iniquity with cords of vanity. Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil. Woe unto them that lo." We find anaphora in Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Anaphora. Or in Beethoven's Second, for that matter. But basta anaphora. On to another. What do you suppose is the rhetorical figure operating in this most unrhetorical Schubert melody? Anybody got any ideas? It is a device that bears the proud name chiasmus, a fancy word that means simply reversing the order of elements midway through a statement. What's Hecuba to him, or he to Hecuba? Or John Kennedy's, "Ask not what your country can do for you, or what you can do for your country." A-B-B-A. Notice again how this figure is based on repetition, as they all are. Repetition subjected to reversal. A-B-B-A. And Schubert, blissfully unaware of chiasmus, just went ahead and created one. A-B-B-A. Now that's so obviously dependent on repetition, it barely needs mentioning. What's important is the variation of those A's and B's, which has transformed them into a musical metaphor. And the X factor here is clearly the symmetrical design itself, A, B, B, A. I was astonished one day suddenly to discover a huge chiasmus just squatting there in so unpretentious a piece as Chabrier's Rhapsody, España. You know the Rhapsody, España? Now this one, this chiasmus, involves two whole different consecutive tunes, not just bars, tunes, one a chiastic version of the other. The first one goes, this is the A. B. Then it, they're both repeated. Here's A again. B. And then the chiasmus breaks open. B. A. B. B. A. And so on. A perfect reversal. Incredible, I find it, and much more than just an amusing game, although I'm tempted to go on playing it, but it's showing off, after all. But I have found ropalisms in Beethoven's First Symphony and polysyndetons in Petrushka and asyndeton in Bruckner, but fun is fun. What's seriously striking about all this is that all these figures of speech, all these poetic and or rhetorical devices, are transformations in our old familiar Chomskyan sense. And as we know, all musical transformations lead to metaphorical results. So a piece of music is a constant metamorphosis of given material involving such transformational devices as inversion, augmentation, retrograde, diminution, modulation, the opposition of consonants and dissonance, the various forms of imitation like canon and fugue, the varieties of rhythm and meter, harmonic progressions, coloristic dynamic changes, plus the infinite interrelations of all these with one another. These are the meanings of music. And that's as close as I can come to a definition of musical semantics. Now, after a brief pause, we're going to see and hear a filmed performance of Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F. Why this particular symphony in this particular lecture? Beethoven's 6th would seem to be the least likely piece on earth to illustrate purely musical meanings, which is, after all, what we've been talking about, since it's encumbered from start to finish with non-musical meanings. For openers, it bears the subtitle Pastoral, which instantly places the work in an area of extra musical meaning, namely the area of the countryside. And as if that weren't enough, each of its 5 movements bears its own subtitle, The Awakening of Cheerful Feelings on Arriving in the Country. That's 1. Seen by the Brook, 2nd movement, and Happy Gathering of the Peasant Folk, The Storm, 4, and finally, A Shepherd's Song of Joy and Thankfulness After the Storm. Now, that alone would be enough to distract any listener's attention from such things as inversions and subdominance, to say nothing of deletions and permutations. But no, Beethoven goes even further and injects actual onomatopoetic references to country life, bird calls and village bands, lightning and thunder and shepherd's pipes. It's as close to program music as Beethoven ever came. So why the pastoral on this lecture, where we're concerned not with the birds and the bees, but with the Fs and the Cs? Took me a week to think that one up. The notes, the Fs and the Cs, the notes themselves, which form the intrinsic metaphors of music. Metaphors that evolve out of syntactic and phonological transformations. And that's precisely the reason I've chosen it, to clarify and distinguish between one kind of metaphor and another, between the intrinsic and the extrinsic, the musical and the verbal. I'll try to help you, before we hear it, somewhat at the piano, and then we can go on playing our game to determine whether it's possible for us to listen to this piece as pure music, not as a pastoral symphony, but rather purely as Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F major, Opus 68. Do you think it's possible? That's what we're going to find out after this pause.